Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Season 5, Episode 10 of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We are already on episode number 10, if you can believe it, for season number 5, where we're talking about the NADLA Mr. Universe contest. And today on the show, we've got author Randy Roach, and Randy is the author of the book Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. And he actually has 3 volumes on that, volume 1, 2, and 3. And Randy is going to talk to us about the history of the NADLA Mr. Universe contest. It has a long history, as we mentioned before. It started in 1950. So Randy's going to go into how the NADLA Universe got started. He's going to go all the way back to the 1800s, believe it or not. And we're going to talk about the Eugene Sandow trophy that is now being used for the Mr. Olympia competitions. And they actually got the idea for that from the very first NADLA Mr. Universe contest in 1950 with Steve Reeves. And Eugene Sandow actually gave that trophy away. It was a likeness of himself. He gave that trophy away for his contest, which was, I think, either the first bodybuilding competition ever held or one of the very first bodybuilding shows ever held. So Randy's going to have all that information for us. So it's going to be a great history lesson today on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. All right, I want to mention also we are brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One. Everybody wants to be a champion. Everybody wants to be the best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or running a 6-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And you can feel your body after the workouts with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And you can enter the discount code LEGENDS, and you'll get 15% discount off your order. And I was watching the social media stuff that happened at the Arnold Classic over the weekend, and Aaron Singerman, the CEO of Redcon One, he was out there, and they just introduced a new bar, an MRE bar, with all these different flavors. So check that out when you go to redcon1.com. And we're also brought to you by Old School Labs. With so many supplements on the market, it's hard to know which brand is the right one. As a 3-time Natural Mr. Universe and Natural Mr. Olympia, the quality of supplements and knowing what I'm taking is very important to me, which is why Old School Labs is giving you 12% off your purchase. So just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at the checkout, and you will get a 12% discount off your order. And I want to congratulate Breon Ansley, who is an ambassador for Old School Labs. He just won the Arnold Classic over the weekend, as I predicted he would. Breon definitely has the best classic physique look that they are looking for. He just won the Olympia a few months ago. This is the first time they had the classic physique at the Arnold Classic, and he won the very first one. So congratulations to him. To me, it didn't even look close from the pictures that I saw. So go to oldschoollabs.com and check out the supplements that myself and Breon Ansley are taking. They also sponsor Sergio Oliva Jr., one of the top pros in the world, and Samir Benoot, 1983 Mr. Olympia, is taking their supplements, and also Tom Platz. Check out Vintage Brawn Protein, which is their new protein powder with the protein coming from whole food sources. So you want to check that out at oldschoollabs.com. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to oldschoollabs.com. And you'll get 12% off their order. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, as I mentioned, the Arnold Classic was last weekend, and I did not get a chance to attend it, but I was checking it all out online. And William Bonick was the winner, his very first Arnold Classic that he ever entered, and he won it. So congratulations to him. I predicted in my article I wrote for Old School Labs that William would win it because I figured he had the momentum, and he's got a fantastic physique. He's very densely and thickly developed, and he always comes in condition. He's very, very consistent. He never misses his peak. So I figured with all those factors going for him, William would win the show, even though it was a much bigger and better lineup than it was last year. But after William took third at the Olympia, only getting beat by Big Ramy and by Phil Heath, Mr. Olympia champion, I figured that he would be able to beat Dexter Jackson, and Sean Roden was supposed to compete in it, but he dropped out. And Dexter did, in fact, take second place at 48 years old, and Dexter looks just amazing still. But William Bonick is just a better bodybuilder, and I think guys like Dexter and Sean Roden are going to have a really hard time beating this guy at the Olympia. Cedric McMillan, who I was pulling for, but I figured he would not win it, he did, in fact, take third place. Cedric was the winner last year, and I think Cedric, as I said before, I think he's got the best physique in pro bodybuilding, even better than Phil Heath, but he just has to show up. Let me put it this way. He has the best physique potential, but he just doesn't really make it. He doesn't very rarely hits that potential, unfortunately. He did hit it last year at the Arnold Classic, and usually the Arnold Classic is the show where Cedric really hits his peak. And after winning it last year, I was hoping he was going to repeat. And he could have repeated, I think. He would have beat William Bonick and Dexter if he would have shown up at his all-time best. But he didn't look quite as big or as impressive as he did last year. He just sort of seemed to fade in the background. He wasn't as dominant as he was last year. Maybe holding a little bit of water. Just looked maybe a little flat. I don't know. He just wasn't really, really peaked like he was last year. So, unfortunately, Cedric took third. We'll see what happens at the Olympia, but usually Cedric does not hit his peak at the Olympia for some reason. But I think William Bonick's going to do really good at the Olympia this year. He should be challenging Phil Heath for that top prize, all depending on what Big Ramy looks like. And Rolly Winkler looked really, really good too. I mean, super massive. This is the biggest I think Rolly's ever looked. Can't really criticize him too much. He just doesn't have that aesthetic look to his physique that someone like Dexter has or Cedric has. But he is a freak, and he was in good condition, so he wasn't like he was out of shape. Again, congratulations to Breon Ansley. This was the 30th show of the Arnold Classic because it started in 1989. It was not the 30th anniversary. I don't know why they keep calling it the 30th anniversary when it was actually the 30th show. They also did that with the Olympia a couple of years ago. The Olympia started, of course, in 1965. So the 50th anniversary of the Mr. Olympia should have been 2015. But on 2014, they celebrated the 50th Mr. Olympia, and everybody started calling it the 50th anniversary. But I remember in 1995, they had the 30th anniversary of the Mr. Olympia, and that's when they had all the previous Mr. Olympias come out on stage with Joe Weider. So, yeah, I don't know why they keep doing that now. They sort of changed the rule book, and now they're calling it, it's not the 30th anniversary, but it was the 30th show. So next year at the Arnold Classic will be the 30th anniversary, but I'm sure they won't celebrate that because they already celebrated a year earlier. So anyways, at the 30th Arnold Classic this year, last weekend, they had all the former champions come out on stage. So that was really impressive. They had Rich Gaspari, who was the 1989 Arnold Classic winner. And then they had Mike Ashley, who was the first drug-tested and only drug-tested Arnold Classic winner. And we had Mike Ashley on the show before, and we've also had Rich on the show. Sean Ray was 1991. And then after him, let's see if I can remember my history, Vince Taylor won it in 1992, and then Flex Wheeler was up there. He won it in 1993. Kevin Livroni was there looking very big. I guess he's going to compete again later this year. I'm not sure what show he's doing. I think he's doing a show in Australia. And then they had Mike Francois, who was a native of Columbus, Ohio. He is from the 1995 winner. He beat out Flex Wheeler that year. And they had Ronnie Coleman, who was coming back from back surgery. Jay Cutler was there. Let's see, who else was there? Oh, of course, Dexter and Cedric and Dennis Wolf. They were all competing this year. And Kai Green, I believe, was there also. I'm forgetting a couple of the guys. But they had all the guys there except for, of course, Nasser Elsambadi, who passed away. He was the 1999 winner. But it was really a great event. And I guess they had like a seminar, over an hour seminar with Bob Ciccarillo moderating, where they had all the former champions on stage. So I wish I could have saw that because I love the history of the sport as much as anybody. But I was out in Colorado this last weekend. I was at a conference. It's put on by an organization called AAAI, which is an aerobics organization, -ISMA, which is a personal fitness and strength and conditioning organization. And I actually gave a class on the strength and conditioning class because the teacher that was supposed to come out there for it, she got stuck out east because of that nor'easter they had. So she was not able to make it. So they asked me to jump in and fill in for her. And I also gave a couple seminars on natural bodybuilding, which is the reason I went out there in the first place. So it was great meeting all those people in this organization. It's a really good organization. It's been around for like 37 years. And they've got another one coming up on June 1st through 3rd out in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So I'll be out there for that. And that's supposed to be a huge convention. It's going to be at the Atlantic City Convention Center. They're supposed to have like 2,000 people there. So if you guys are interested in getting certified either in any kind of aerobics class or personal training or certification, then go check them out. The website, sort of a long website, it's aaai-ismafitness.com. aaai-ismafitness.com. So check them out if you're on the East Coast, or even if you're not on the East Coast, you want to travel out there and go to Atlantic City for the weekend and get certified. And I will be out there again giving a seminar on natural bodybuilding. And I think I'm also going to be teaching the strength and conditioning course, the certification course. So I'll be doing that again. I also want to mention that Old School Labs has been talking to me about going out to the West Coast in California and doing some interviews with some of the old time guys. So I think we're planning that for around June. So I will keep you guys updated on that. But that sounds like a great time. And I'm actually dieting right now. I'm looking forward to doing some photo shoots right around that time. So hopefully by June, I'll be in shape enough to do that. I'm going on a cruise this weekend for my birthday. So after that, the diet is on. I've been dieting for the last couple months, and I've lost a couple inches off my waist since the holidays, since I got back from Chicago for Christmas. So really be hitting it hard the next 3 months, March, April, and May, to try and get in great shape by June. And I'll do some photo shoots in June and July to celebrate my 55th birthday. I can't believe I'm 55 already. So just keep going. All right. Speaking of looking great, I want to mention our other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. They offer very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. So those are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. You can find them online at flalternativemeds.com. That is their website. Or if you want to call them, you can call their office at 813-922-8939 and can schedule an appointment to talk to them. And they will check out your hormone levels and see where you're at and offer you products that can get you in optimum health. Again, their office number is 813-922-8939. And if you want to check out their website, go to flalternativemeds.com. And they will help you out. They will work with anybody in the continental United States. They're in Tampa, Florida, but they will work with anybody. So you can just contact them and talk to them by Skype or phone. So give them a call. They've been helping out a lot of people out here in the Tampa, Florida area, and they're doing a great job. All right. So that is our opening for the podcast. Here is our interview with Mr. Randy Roach. He was our first guest, actually, when we started this podcast about 6 months ago. And Randy is going to be talking about the history of the NABBA Mr. Universe contest and how the IFBB got started. And we're also going to talk about how that Sandow statue made its way over from the NABBA Universe contest over to the Mr. Olympia. So here's our interview with Randy Roach. Enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And on the line with me today is Randy Roach. Randy is the author of the book Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, which is volume 1, 2, and 3. And he's a great historian of the sport, and he's been on our show before, so we wanted to talk to him about the NABBA universe. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Glad to be back.
You were our first guest, I think, on the podcast, Randy, the very first one we did.
Oh, that was Pumping Iron, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was about Pumping Iron, right.
Yeah, it was a good series.
Well, Randy, I wanted to talk to you about the NABBA universe. We've been doing podcasts about this subject for the last 10 weeks or so. We did one with Wayne Galash when we started the series. And we talked about how the show started in 1950. That was the first official one with Steve Reeves. But actually, they had another one 2 years before that. I don't know if they called it Mr. Universe, but it was when John Grimmick won. So I want to talk to you about the history of the NABBA Universe. And you know a lot about Oscar Heidenstam, who started the organization and started the contest. So Tell us a little bit about how the whole NABBA universe got started.
To understand the Mr. Universe, especially the NABBA Mr. Universe, how it was derived and how it rose to prominence and why it declined from that prominent position, it's mm-hmm. important to understand bodybuilding's relationship with weightlifting and two prominent figures, Oscar Hayenstam, Oscar State.
Okay.
If you go back, you can go back. Actually, 1890. We'll go back to 1898. It's kind of a good, significant year because actually, bodybuilding and weightlifting, even though they're so far apart right now, they're actually married at the hip for quite some time. Even though many figured that never the twain shall meet, right? But in 1898, like John Atkinson in the London Athletic Institute ran a physique contest on the heels of a weightlifting competition. But at that same year, Hopton Headley had, it's 1898, 1892, and 1900 are all kind of years that pop up for Hopton to have started the Health and Strength magazine. Health and Strength magazine is a very important entity in British bodybuilding. They actually, that group started the Health and Strength League in 1905, and these two organizations would be very prominent in British physical culture. In fact, they were instrumental in a meeting in 1910 to establish the American Weightlifting Association, which became the British Amateur Weightlifting Association, called BALA, in 1911. There wasn't any real international governing bodies for these sports of bodybuilding and weightlifting at that time. They were kind of national, regional events and beer hall competitions and showcasing, like Sandow and Vaudeville. But a big thing at that time was the return of the Olympics in 1896. Weightlifting had I believe it was part of the first games, but it wasn't consistent in the games until 1920 when Jules Rousset in France started the International Weightlifting Federation. This is very important for the Mr. Universe here, which the International Weightlifting Federation was also known as the Fédération Internationale Halterophile. That's extended my French, but people refer to it as the FIC or the IWF, but that year was important, 1920, when it started, because it was coordinating with the International Olympic Committee to become a consistent representation of the Olympic Games. In fact, what happened there, there were organizations trying to be started by guys like Alan Calvert, George Jowett, David Willoughby, and Mark Berry, but because of the weightlifting coming into the Olympic Games, the Amateur Athletic Union, AAU, took control of American amateur weightlifting in 1928. And that's actually when the three lifts, the press, the jerk, and the snatch were established.
Olympic weightlifting started in the 1920 games then, the 1920 Olympics.
Consistently. It was then sporadically before that, between 1896, but it was going to become more consistent. And that's when the International Weightlifting Federation was established out of France, and it would be coordinating with the IOC to be in a consistent sport in the games. So the Amateur Athletic Union was the dominant, it started in 1888, it was going to become the dominant athletic coordinating body for sports in America. Wanted to go to the Olympics, even with the gymnastics and all that stuff. It kind of ran through the Amateur Athletic Union. And because now AAU was controlling weightlifting, by the time the Mr. Americas were coming around 1939, the AAU weightlifting committee sanctioned one in 1939 that Roland Esmacher won, and it ran on the heels of AAU national weightlifting competition.
That was the first Mr. America, the 1939 Mr. America, that was the first one?
Well, there's always been controversy. Burt Goodrich won one that was called the Mr. America, but some say not so much. But then it was only weeks away that the AAU had their national weightlifting championships, and they held another bodybuilding event called the Mr. America. It was sanctioned by the AAU. So it's debating as to which is first and stuff. But John Gremick won in 1940-41, and some people think that was the,
Who was the winner in 1939, Roland Esmacher?
Roland Esmacher was the first winner with the AAU connected to it.
Okay, so but Burt Goodrich won another Mr. America that wasn't AAU.
Yeah, a few weeks before that.
A few weeks before. Oh, okay. Yeah, I always heard that, too. I always heard Burt Goodrich was the first Mr. America.
That started American bodybuilding under the umbrella, amateur bodybuilding under the umbrella of weightlifting, because it was controlled by the AAU National Weightlifting Committee. Okay.
When did Bob Hoffman start the Health and Strength magazine?
He started Strength and Health. That's the thing. Okay, Britain has the health and strength, and in 1932, Hoffman started Strength and Health. He had the oil burner business in 1928, and he started building some barbells, but he established a magazine. He was a smart marketing guy. Through the Depression, that's what his oil burner business kept him going, and actually because the Depression helped elevate him in power, because while everybody was going out of business, he was flourishing, and he started Strength and Health magazine in 1932, rose to prominence in weightlifting, and started York Barbell in 1938. So by 1940s, he was the most powerful figure in American amateur weightlifting.
Yeah.
Okay, but now 1930, Health and Strength and magazine, Health and Strength League, they're starting to run Mr. and Miss Britain competitions. Like, so they, even though they were at that meeting that started the British Amateur Weightlifting Association in 1910, again, these are all physical culture events, weightlifting, physique shows. So in 1937, a prominent name, Oscar Heidenstam, he won that Mr. Britain contest, okay?
When did the Mr. Now, Britain start again, Brandon?
Pardon me? Around 1930, they started the whole new Health and Strength League. And Health
That's an old contest, Mr. Britain.
Yeah, it's a very old contest, one of the oldest ones.
Yeah.
So by the 1940s, bodybuilding was taken off in the United States. But in 1947, Bob Hoffman was the director of the World Weightlifting Championships.
Okay.
And Dietrich Ward... what was his last name? Dietrich Ward. I forget his last name. He was the chairman of the AAU National Weightlifting Committee. They were both officers on the International Weightlifting Committee, and they were going to run a bodybuilding show.
Okay.
On the heels of the World Weightlifting Championships. And they decided to call the Mr. Universe. Now, this time, John Gramick, by this time, was declared a professional, and he was not allowed to compete. He would have won it, but he was not allowed to compete. He had just got through that fiasco with Dan Lurie when Lurie called him out in that physique challenge, I think in 1946. Gramick, they wouldn't let Dan compete. They said Dan was a pro, but John wasn't, which was ridiculous. But by 1947, they recognized that John Gramick was a professional. So Steve Stanko won the very first Mr. Universe contest. Stanko was the first guy to total 1,000 pounds in weightlifting. The clean and jerk press and the snatch. Stanko was that guy. He was a strong guy.
So this was 47 then? 1947?
1947, yep. Held in Philadelphia.
Was that in an AAU Mr. Universe though?
No, it was sanctioned by it was held on the heels of the World Weightlifting Championship.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was sanctioned by the International Weightlifting Federation, the FIC. The AAU was the American. It was just American Amateur Athletics.
Yeah,
right? But they were coordinated with the International Weightlifting Federation. There's a lot of acronyms and names and organizations to remember. Like
it's
been 10 years since I released Volume 1, so you got to bear with me because there's a lot of years.
Well, it sounds like you're doing pretty good.
it was fairly successful. So the next year, they're going to hold another one. They held that the 1940 Olympic Games, and along with the British Empire Weightlifting Championships, they're going to hold it again. Now, some have thought that the International Weightlifting Federation, or the FIC, didn't sanction this one, but they actually did, because Oscar State now, he was the assistant director in the International Weightlifting Federation, and he was also the secretary of the BALA, the British Amateur Weightlifting. He worked with that British Amateur Weightlifting Championship. They're going to hold another Mr. Universe in London.
Right.
And Oscar State participated in an official capacity. I think he was the MC. So there was the FIC actually did, in a sense, sanction these two, first 47-48, but we found out later that Oscar, in a letter to Bob Hoffman in 1965, when he was kind of scolding Hoffman for competing, recognizing the NABBA when he shouldn't have been, he listed off the FIC Mr. Universes, and he started it at 1950 with John Probotnick. He didn't include the 47-48 for whatever reason. They didn't include it. But what happened was that was the first first real controversial contest between when Reeves and Gramick went head-to-head in 1948.
Right.
And some thought, well, Reeves had the better physique.
Mm-hmm.
Gramick was the better exhibitionist and stuff. But regardless, Gramick won. Reeves was quite graceful in it. But the Oscar State did not like running bodybuilding and weightlifting events together. And that was supposedly the reason why the FIC, or the International Weightlifting Federation, did not run a 1949 Mr. Universe.
Okay.
But Health and Strength League and Health Strength Magazine and Link House Publishing, that was connected with them and published the magazine, they were quite happy with the success of that 1948 Mr. Universe. Mm-hmm. But they thought they'd move to create an independent body, the National Amateur Bodybuilders Association. And again, there was some resistance about running bodybuilding shows with weightlifting shows coming from Oscar State. But the International Weightlifting Federation, they were okay with whatever the NAVOs, if they were going to run some shows along with weightlifting, that was fine. So Oscar State was probably instrumental then in getting the International Weightlifting Federation to once again run Mr. Universes. And that was starting in 1950. John Probotnick won that first Mr. Universe. And Tommy Cohn, that Mr. Universe run by the FIC was going to be primarily weightlifters. They weren't going to be necessarily the best bodybuilders. Like Tommy Kona was a fantastic champion weightlifter, and he won four in a row in the 1950s. But there was a falling out here. This is important because Oscar Hayden-Stamp, even though he wasn't present and he was in World War II and still in the military at the time of the forming of the NAVA, they consulted with Oscar quite a bit through letters. And Oscar actually competed in the 1948 Mr. Universe, and then he competed in the NAVA's very first, the initiatives for NAVA was in 1949, and their first Mr. Universe was 1950, as you know, run by Steve Rees, and he was awarded the bronze statuette. I'm not sure how they acquired the bronze Sandow statuette that was given out in the 1901 Great Competition when Sandow ran that over in England, when William Murray got the gold. I forget who got the silver and the bronze, but we'll remember that because that's going to come to bear later on when we talk about that gold trophy.
Right. I want to talk about that.
Yeah, Rees was awarded, and he won a close decision over Reg Park. You know, Reg Park won the Mr. Universe, the NAVA Universe, the next year. But Oscar State, being the secretary of the BALA, British Amateur Weightlifting Association, he was trying to exercise power over the newly formed NAVA, and they weren't going to let this happen. So there was a falling out, okay? Got to remember now, Oscar, this was going to be somewhat good for NAVA, but also it's going to serve to be bad for NAVA. Because Oscar State, he was going to start becoming friendly with Joe and Ben Weider, who had just a few years previous worked on getting the IFBB, the International Federation of Bodybuilders, established with the help of Emmanuel Ulrich and George Jowett. But
now, when did that start, Randy, the IFBB? When was the official start of that?
I'd say 1948. I looked hard at when, the Weiders made claims that they've been running world championships for so many back in 1946, and they were not.
Okay.
Looking at the origins of that very deep, they started, Ulrich and Jowett Ghost wrote for Joe in a magazine, and they were looking to start an organization. And Jowett and Ulrich was a very highly influential person. Both Jowett and Ulrich were. Ulrich was probably giving out the name. I wrote, and I believe the evidence showed, that Dan Lurie actually ran the first IFBB show in New York in 1948. And the Weiders, after that, you can look at their magazines and their advertising, retrofitted their show they ran a day after, and another show in 1947. In the magazines, it was never advertised as IFBB, anything like that. Only Dan's show was advertised as an IFBB, and then in later night, they retrofitted their shows to be IFBB. But it wasn't really officially, I don't think, the IFBB until 1948. And they ran a Mr. America, I think, in 1949, but I think it was 48. There was some mix-up as to when they claim it was and then the actual year was run, but they went dormant mostly through the 50s, just running Mr. Canada shows. They were not running any Mr. Universe or World Championships during the 1950s. They covered the NAVA that was forming, and Oscar State, because he was now on the outs with NAVA, he was becoming a little, started to get to know Ben. Ben Weider was young, and Ben was an entrepreneur and trying his best as a statesman for bodybuilding to work on it on a national level. And Oscar, being the assistant secretary of the International Weightlifting Federation, this is going to be important because Oscar, and now remember, this International Weightlifting Federation is going to run bodybuilding shows. So they were going to have this growing international infrastructure that's going to become important into the 1960s. So there's a falling out with Oscar State and the NABBA, and Oscar Haydenstam, now back from the military, would become a powerful people. He would become, I think, the secretary of the NABBA and later become the editor of Health and Strength magazine, all in the 1950s. And through the 1950s, the AAU would send their, Mr. America would usually go over and compete in the NABBA amateur. But again, when Oscar State split with NABBA and having such power with the International Weightlifting Federation and their bodybuilding arm, they didn't recognize the NABBA amateur. So, and they recognized the AAU in the United States, but they did not recognize the NABBA amateur bodybuilding show. But if somebody in the United States won the Mr. America AU, there was nothing else left for him there. So they didn't care if they went over and competed in the NABBA because there's nothing to come back in the AU to compete for.
Right.
So a number of the AU Mr. Americas did go over and compete in the Mr. Universe. Like Bill Pearl would be one of the bigger names that people would recognize. But I think Ray Schaefer won the Mr. America, went over, won the Mr. Universe in 1956. There was a number of them that did that. But
yeah, I noticed when I was talking to Wayne, we were looking at that, like the guy who won Mr. America that year, would he go over to the Mr. Universe? And it seemed like later on it became like Bill Pearl went in the same year, and a lot of the guys went over in the same year. But when it first started, I think, when NABBA first started, sometimes the guy who won the Mr. America would wait 5 or 6 years before he would go over and compete in the Mr. Universe. So
Tom Sampson is a good example of that. He won
America
in the later 50s, but didn't win the NABBA Universe until the 1963 or something like that. But
yeah.
Often they would go over and compete in the same year. But NABBA was growing in prestige because it was the only big game in town. And they started a professional as well. So once you won an amateur, you could take a crack at the professional version. Because the AAU had nothing else for professionals. The AAU was strictly Amateur Athletic Union.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but the NABBA, again, was strong moving into the 1960s. But the Weiders came back online in 1959. And with their first, the second Mr. America run by Chuck Sipes, strong man, good physique on him.
And, so there was a break with the IFBB then from when they started till 1959?
Yeah, it went dormant. The only thing they were running through the 1950s were Mr. Canada's.
That's interesting.
But they brought it back to play in 1959, and Eddie Silvestre won the Mr. Universe, their Mr. Universe. I think that was their first Mr. Universe.
Their first one, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Eddie Silvestre would run in the Mr. International competitions into the 1970s. He had this
square
code.
I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Tijuana, Mexico, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was the 19th. That's the one with the famous 1973 one with Arnold and Sergio.
Yeah.
But anyways, they came back online, and they weren't, again, the AAU still on the American front was too strong for the Weiders, their Mr. America, and the NABBA was still too strong for them on the Mr. Universe count, but they were starting to move now, especially with when guys like Larry Scott refused to go into the AAU. He didn't like Bob Hoffman. He went over to Weider, won the Mr. America and their Mr. Universe. I think Scott won the American in 62, then in the professional amateur Mr. Universe in 63 and 64. I think Harold Poole beat him out in the overall in 63, but Scott won in 64. But Harold Poole, he was getting a raw deal. What was going to help on the American front was Hoffman was surrounded by accusations of racism, favoritism, plus favoritism to the weightlifters. And the scoring system for the AAU was, it had the appearance points, the general appearance. It had the athletic, symmetry, muscular.
They had to do interviews, right? The Mr. America competitors had to do interviews in a suit and tie.
Yeah. and to do certain things. And like, for example, the Olympic lifts were deemed good for scoring in the athletic event, but just say a bench press wasn't, right?
Those Olympic lifts, how much did they add to the score of the Mr. America competitors?
25%.
25%
was for athletic ability, 25% for muscularity, 75% for symmetry. Sorry, 25% for symmetry and 25% for, did I say general appearance? Those four: muscularity, symmetry, athletic, and general appearance. So, not always the best bodybuilders winning here, right? And that gave a lot of wiggle room for the weightlifter. So, and that's what was happening with Joe Benda, 162, was controversial. Harold Poole and Vern Weaver over Harold Poole again in 63. So Harold went to the IFBB. And then Sergio losing with Guida, even though Guida was a good Mr. America, he had a good physique, and he won by the true criteria of the contest. But even Bob told Sergio, look, Sergio, you're not going to win it here. Because, number one, you're not even an American citizen. Number two, you can't speak English. And plus, the guy's black and he's Cuban at the time. And cool. So Bob advised him to go to the Weeders, right?
Right.
So the Weeders are starting to get some good athletes. Now, what the big thing here that was...
Now, were the Weeders in America at that point, or were they still in Canada?
In the 1950s, they were in the United States. Joe moved down in 1948. He was running for many, many years out of his parents' basement, right?
Yeah.
Montreal.
Right.
But Dan Lurie had arrived back on the scene. Joe and Dan were partners back in the early, mid-40s, and then Dan came back on the scene in 1965. But the big thing that happened here for all the bodybuilding was that Oscar State had taken that friendship with Ben. Mm-hmm. And he gave Ben a heads up in 1966 that the International Weightlifting Federation was no longer going to continue sanctioning bodybuilding shows. Okay, he told Ben to get his acting gear, get an official professional governing body going. Ben, the Weeders was flying by the seat of the pants by this time. They had nothing even registered. He told him to get a federation going, legitimate federation, get his constitution, a Congress going, code of ethics, get that going. Because in 1968, the International Weightlifting Federation was going to drop bodybuilding. And Oscar was going to be instrumental in taking that international infrastructure of other national bodies over to the Weeders. Okay, this is a big move from an international level, because again, in 1967, another General Association of International Sporting Federation, GASEF, was established. It was another international body that would recognize one organization for sport on an international level. And Oscar was going to become, I think, secretary or assistant secretary in this organization as well. So Oscar State, by this time, is the secretary of the International Weightlifting Federation, and very powerful man at that time. The Weeders were very fortunate, because if it wasn't for Oscar, they weren't going to go anywhere. So Oscar came over, and basically he set the Weeders up. He got them this GASEF status in 1971, because the AAU and the Hoffman crowd hated Weeder. They fought all through the 50s and the 60s, and the AAU was never going to affiliate itself with the Weeders, even at the IFBB was considered an international governing body. But when they got this status from the General Association of the International Sporting Federations, they would have to take notice, because Ben was smart, even if he wasn't going to attain it, but to pursue Olympic recognition. Because the bodybuilders didn't have anything. They did from an amateur level. After Mr. America and Mr. Contest, there was no Olympics for them. So to have an Olympics, to have the people at least think they were going to be Olympics, was a very strong status. And the AAU was going to have to eventually work with the IFBB. But Oscar State was important. Now, Oscar Haydenstam, he was different from the Weeders. In terms of, Oscar was the consummate gentleman, amateur sports ideal. He believed in this amateur ideal that sports were conducted in a gentlemanlike manner to enhance the well-being of the person, the individual, from a whole mental, spiritual, physical perspective, right? He wasn't a commercial whore. Where Joe liked bodybuilding, but Joe loved business, and Joe, I called Oscar the consummate idealist, and Joe the commercial realist. He was Joe was business oriented. I won't call Joe a business whore. He was just business oriented. Mm-hmm. But Oscar had Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger first was competing in the NABBA. He came over. He lost to Chet Yornia in 1966. He won the amateur in 67. Three times in a row, he won the professional NABBA, 68, 69, and 70. Oscar had him, but he actually wrote that he thought Arnold should actually step down and let others win, you know, let others compete. So he's still that idealist where Joe's saying, no, we got to keep these bodybuilders around. We got to market these guys. We've got to sell magazines and all this stuff. And that's why he went and nabbed Arnold in 1968. So Joe's getting all this leverage. He's acquiring the best bodybuilders. He's now building this enormous, I won't say enormous, but much more effective governing international infrastructure thanks to Oscar State, where Oscar Hainstam is not moving in this direction. See, by 1969, Boyer Coe had told me, as much as he loved it, winning the AAU Mr. America, it was NABBA. It was, he still said he cherished the Mr. Universe title. Mr. Universe title he won later that year, right?
Right.
And NABBA was still, even though Joe was moving in the right direction, the 1971 Mr. Universe showed still how much NABBA was a better drawing power, because that universe drew Bill Pearl, Sergio Oliva, Reg Park, Frank Zane, Chris Dickerson, who else was down where that's actually a good name you just brought up for a good reason. I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay.
But the Mr. Olympia, 71 Olympia, Arnold won uncontested. When it came to pushing, see, now that they had their constitution, the IFBB had their constitution ratified the year before in Yugoslavia, I think, in 1970, Sergeant Dubray was going to now run the WIDERS organization as a legitimate federation, which means the athletes could not go anywhere unless the IFBB sanctioned it. And the IFBB now was no longer going to let their athletes go compete in NABBA. They had to just go in the IFBB. So, but this backfired on them because they chose to go to compete in the NABBA instead of 1971 Olympia and the Universe. So they were hurt in terms of athletes. And so Arnold wasn't allowed to go compete again. Everybody wanted to see Arnold compete against Sergio and Bill Pearl. Including what Serge Nubray wrote in his manuscript. He said even Ben Weider wanted him to go compete because the Weiders thought Arnold could beat Pearl and probably would have, because Arnold won the previous three NABBA professional universes in a row.
Right.
And he was just more, he was the best body, him and Sergio were the two best bodybuilders of that time. But Serge said, no, he can't, because, not to be a prick, but these are the rules. They can't.
Yeah.
So Ben was actually telling Serge Dubray, well, maybe I could just guest pose at our show. That's so little. He still thought of his own organization where he wants Arnold for marketing reasons to go compete against Pearl and Sergio in the NABBA and just serve as a guest poser at his own Mr. Olympia, right? I thought, oh my, this is crazy.
Yeah. Plus Serge Dubray was promoting the Mr. Olympia that year, so he had to have Arnold in the show, right?
Yeah, he would have loved to have them all in the show.
He was
a sportsman. Like he was a professional, and he was taking Oscar State seriously. I guess Ben and Joe still had business over top of sporting federation governance, right?
Right.
But anyways, the NABBA, that was probably one of the most standout NABBA universes, was a big clash between Bill Pearl and Sergio, because that's when Arthur Jones came to town with Sergio, right? Sergio was huge. Bill was cut. And I talked to a number of people, like Wayne Galash and others who were there and wrote on it, George Coates, and they all gave the nudge. And even Boyer said Sergio was enormous, but Sergio did nothing with diet, and he was just a big chunk of muscle. He was not cut. Where Bill Pearl was just razor sharp. But Bill Pearl said he weighed 238, but everybody says, no way. He wasn't close to that body weight at that leanness, right?
Right.
But the majority of people were there, and they said the lighting was not good and the photographs weren't all that good. You had to be there. Everybody who said they were there said they gave it to Bill Pearl.
Yeah, but that's what
Frank
I heard.
Frank Zane was never given a chance to stand beside Pearl. He won.
They were compared. Right.
Yeah, So Frank was, and here's another thing. Bill Pearl was pretty honest in his book, Beyond the Universe. I laughed when I read this. So he said, behind stage, some young kid, some gentleman brought their young kid to have an autograph by Sergio. Mm-hmm. Sergio was in, you know, contest mode and just, you know, shrugged the kid off, like, you know, get lost, right? And the kid was really downed. I think he just was really dejected. And Bill Pearl said he walked over to the kid, picked him up, gave him a pot in the head, signed an autograph, and he said the next time he saw his father's face was sitting across the table at the judging table. I think it was Jacques Blumhardt, right?
Oh, was
so,
it?
Yes. So Bill said, "Well, that gave me some favor over top of Sergio." I don't know, but he said it certainly didn't hurt, right?
Right.
So he was honest enough to admit that, but it was still one of the most talked about Mr. Universes of the time. But what was happening now? The NABBA was still very prestigious. Guys like Boyer Coe, who won the Mr. American 69. He still didn't go over to the Weavers. He liked Oscar. He liked the NABBA. He loved their trophies and stuff. The cup and the trophy with the pillars and a Grammick lookalike on the top of the pillars. But by the time the Mr. Olympia was still, they were banning some people. For example, here's the irony here in 1971 NABBA and the NABBA Universe and the IFBB Mr. Olympia. Sergio wasn't allowed to compete. He could only guest pose at the Mr. Olympia the next week. Arnold wasn't allowed to go compete in the NABBA. Franco was not allowed to compete in the amateur Mr. Universe. But Albert Beckles was allowed to compete in both.
Yeah.
So everybody's going, what the hell? You know, you got Albert Beckles competed, and then he came over the next week and won. I think he won his class in the Mr. Universe.
He won his class at the NABBA, and then he won the overall at the IFBB.
Yeah, it was politics again. Wayne Glasser, basically, Albert was a strong competitor for and representing the United Kingdom. It was a good stance against the NABBA that way. But, you know, that's how goofy the politics and bodybuilding were at that time, because they were banning. Frank Zane got banned for a bit, and Dennis Arena got banned for a bit for competing in the NABBA Universe, because Zane won the NABBA Universe Amateur in 1970. I think Casey in 1972 or 73, but the Mr. Olympia was still sputtering a bit. You get Franco, you get Arnold, you get Sergio Bray, right? You get those two guys. Where the NABBA, Boyer Coe went on to win the 73 and 75 Mr. Universe shows, but the turning point was when Arnold retired in 75, and then he became a team with Lorimer and began promotion.
Yeah.
So the 1976 Mr. Olympia was a step up in cash, and the other big thing that happened was the staging presentation was much better, and Arnold was able to persuade Boyer Coe to come over to the IFBB. So that was the turning point where NABBA wasn't, their trophies are good, but there wasn't really anything for money being given out. So the IFBB now, with Oscar State, with Schwarzenegger and Lorimer getting into promotion, Wayne D'Amelio was going to come on the scene. Ken Sprague was a powerful entity in the 1970s. Wayne would be much more powerful in the 1980s, but Wayne started his Night of Champions in 1978. So IFBB, the Weeders had some good catalysts working for them. Oscar State. Ken Sprague was, you know, I wrote in the second volume what he did to take power away from the AAU, because the National Sports Act of 1978 was instrumental in breaking up the stronghold of weightlifting over top of bodybuilding. Every amateur sport was going to have its own autonomous governing body, national governing body, they were actually called. So that's when the AAU turned into the NPC through the late 70s and early 80s. And by the time the smoke cleared in the early 1980s, the Weeders were in charge of bodybuilding, both on an amateur and professional level.
Let me take you back to Oscar State. You said, what was the reason why he left NABBA and went over to the Weeders? You might have mentioned that, but.
It was like Oscar apparently did not at first want bodybuilding and weightlifting on the same venue. NABBA didn't mind, you know, they didn't care. Like, bodybuilding was usually a better draw. But Oscar relented. But then he remember, Oscar was not just at that time in the early 1950s. He was the assistant secretary of the International Weightlifting Federation. He was the secretary of the British Amateur Weightlifting Association, and he wanted that BALA, as they called British Amateur Weightlifting Association, to take a control of NABA, and NABA wasn't going to allow that. So after 1952, state was gone. He was totally off any type of connection with the NABA.
Okay.
So that's created the rift, but at that same time, he was becoming friendly with the young Ben Weider, even though the Weiders really didn't have much of a pot to piss in still at that time. But he always took a liking to the Weiders. You can see it in his correspondence, and that's why he took Ben under his wing in 1966 and gave him the tip of get your act in order, get your ducks in a row, and I'm going to bring you over. Well, he's going to bring all that infrastructure, all those national bodies that had some type of bodybuilding organization, and we're going to give it to you into your federation. And then he got him that GESA status, and he needed that professional and recognizable infrastructure to get any chance at Olympic recognition, right?
Right.
So it was a very significant time from the late 60s into the early 1980s where a lot of politics took place and the Weiders got their hegemony over the sport. And Dan Lurie and Oscar, they were too late. By the time Oscar realized this, the NABA joined forces with the WABA. Okay, Serge Mubray was on the, after 1975, there's a lot going, I won't get into this, a lot that went on in Pretoria in 1975. We might have even talked about that in our first interview.
Yeah.
Serge Mubray was on the outs. He was on the outs now. Weider had kicked him out. So
right.
Serge started the WABA, World Amateur Bodybuilding Association, in 1976. And then they joined, because they could see now that the Weiders were gaining power, and they were going to get control of American amateur bodybuilding from the AAU, and that was a big move for the Weiders.
Mm-hmm.
They joined up together, and they made Oscar the president of this affiliation between WABA and NABA. It almost sounds like the Flintstones, doesn't it? WABA, NABA. and they put up a front, but that Oscar didn't like the antics of Serge. And even the AAU tried to...
Are you talking about Oscar State or Oscar Heidenstam?
Oscar Heidenstam didn't like the antics because Oscar was made the president. Yeah, I got to get my Oscar State here. Oscar Heidenstam was made the president of this affiliation of the WABA and NABA. And even when the AAU kind of resented losing to the NPC, when he became the NPC, the AAU tried to they kept the Mr. America trademark. So they try to revamp it on their own away from the NPC, and they temporarily try to hook up with the WABA-NABA connection.
But oh, really?
Something went wrong at the 1983 World Championships. Heidenstam did not like what Mubray did, kind of arranged it for himself or whatever, and they split. Then the NABA became NABA International, and I don't know much on the NABA from that point on. I know that Oscar was the president of NABA International until he died in 1992. He had sold the magazine, I think, to Malcolm Wyatt owned it for a while, then he sold it to Roy Edwards in 98. And Roy, I'm not sure, Roy just retired the magazine just recently within the last year or so. Roy was a good guy. And so was Malcolm. Malcolm and Roy both were helpful to me in some of the stuff I was writing, but...
Serge Mubray started WABA in 76 then, after the Pretoria, South Africa, IFBB Olympia. Okay.
Yes, yes. And then they joined forces with NABA in 77 through 83, then that split after that 1980 World Championships. But by that time, D'Amelio was on the scene. He was really building up the IFBB professional front with the Grand Prix.
Right.
Really bringing a lot. 84, he brought in $100,000. Prize money into the Mr. Olympia, got Sergio back, and everybody was starting to follow the IFBB. Like the NABA and the AAU stay hung around, but they had fallen from their big recognition. But the AAU, I think it was finished in 1999. The Mr. America trademark is now being brought back to life, and you know about the NPC split with IFBB, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Mr. America is back, and it's probably going to be brought back to its prominence again as the
national
qualifier. Yeah, because Wayne D'Amelio was approached by Rafael Santonio to build a new American affiliate since the NPC is out. That's probably a different topic altogether, but we kind of jumped way ahead. But
yeah,
there was there was that period between 1968 and 1982 that the IFBB took power of amateur and professional bodybuilding. Even though the Navas still continued to have good athletes in their shows, Jeff King. I remember the Charles Clermont had a great physique.
Yeah, great physique.
He was a Nava Universe winner in the 1980s and stuff.
Do you think when Weider started banning them because they competed in Nava, do you think that was kind of a necessary step? Looking back now, was it a necessary step for the IFBB to step forward away from Nava?
No, I think it just hurt the bodybuilders. The National Sports Act of 1978 stopped that. And the NPC violated that for quite a long time. That Sports Act allowed the crossing over. Even when the act actually began in 1975 with the President's Commission on Athletic Sports in 75 under President Ford, that they looked into breaking up the power of the AAU and the NCAA. And a lot of that power was transferred over to the United States Olympic Committee. So everything was being structured over. But the athletes were allowed, amateur athletes were allowed to compete anywhere, IFBB. And they were starting to do that a little bit in the 70s. But then they started getting, the athletes didn't know about the law, and they could be intimidated, so they were being kind of coerced not to leave. But on the professional level, if you signed contracts, you had to be in a certain organization. But no, they didn't really have to do that. It would have just served, it's all power and greed and control. Everybody wants to have total control, and at the expense of the athletes and the fans. As we saw with everybody wanted to see Sergio compete against Arnold, even in 71 and again in 73.
Yeah.
In Tijuana, they made a mess of it, so Sergio didn't even come to the Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it just hurt. It just served to hurt. That's the nature of a lot of the sports. It's just who's got control, who has control.
Yeah.
Stuff where the pumping iron, I think we had talked about Dennis Tenorino would have been a great character. He had won the professional Mr. Universe in 75, and he would be the odds-on favorite to challenge Arnold. Nope, he had to go to because he had competed. I think Frank Zane was Frank. No, was Frank over? And Frank Zane had been banned, but he may have been back by then. But all those guys, if they competed there, they couldn't
pass over. Yeah, Frank was in the 75 Olympia. All right, let's talk about the trophy then for the Nava Universe, Randy, because this is an interesting topic. I talked to Boyer Cole a little bit about it, and I talked to Wayne DeLash about it. So the very first trophy they used for the Nava Universe was the Sandow Trophy, and this was in 1950 when Steve Reeves won.
The third-place bronze statuette of Sandow, like in 1901, Sandow held that great competition over in England. It was won by William Murray. But I don't know how the Nava acquired that statuette. Did Wayne Glash know how they acquired it?
No. So you said, when Eugene Sandow ran this contest in 1901, he used a trophy that was basically a statuette of himself, right?
Yeah, I think it was forged out several years earlier. It was claimed to be solid gold, another one solid silver, and the other one solid bronze, but we learned later it was just plated gold and silver plated. But
yeah.
Boyer had said there was some time before, not before 1950, but after 1950, that he saw Steve Reeves with that trophy. And he was curious as to what happened to the gold
and the silver
version of it. And I think he and David Webster, who was another prominent figure in British Iron Game and the author of the Iron Game book back in 1976, he tracked down the Murray family, and the Murray family, it was family heirloom. They did not want to sell the trophy, but they allowed Webster to bring the trophy to the 1975 Mr. Universe. And Boyer was photographed with this trophy, and he sent me this whole row of photos of him carrying the trophy, and I put put that photograph in Volume 2 of Muscle Smoking Mirrors.
I remember seeing that. Yeah.
Now, what happened with the trophy Steve Rees was able to buy it from the Murray family. And the funny thing was, the story goes that he then had given it to Serge Nubre to give back to him as an award at a banquet in 1977, which is kind of funny. Which is cool. Reeves can get away with anything like that. But
the one that Reeves won at the 1950 Mr. Universe, he didn't get to keep that?
I believe he did, but both the gold one and the bronze one ended up in the hands of George Helmer, a collector. Now, I'm not sure what he's done with them since the few years ago, several years ago that I had spoken to him. But the whole notion, but the whole statuette thing, Boyer spoke to Oscar Haydenstam and said, why don't you make that? Because somehow between 1950 and by the time like when Boyer's went, the individual class winners in the Navajo Universe would get a silver cup. And the overall winner would get this nice trophy with three columns and statuette of like Grimmick on top of the pose. And Boyer loved the trophy. Like, he still kept. Boyer's given away a lot of his trophies to kids and stuff like that, but that one he's kept. But he talked to Oscar about bringing back the Sandow statuette to be awarded to the winner, but Oscar wasn't interested. But in 1976, when Schwarzenegger was able to convince Boyer to come over and compete, Boyer was talking to these, I think, who was all on the bus with Arnold and...
Arnold, Jim Larmer, maybe Wayne D'Amelio?
No, Wayne wasn't on that bus there. It was just a few there talking. Bill Drake might have been one of them. They were... Boyer brought up the idea and said that he had suggested to Oscar to make return the statuette as the trophy for the Mr. Universe, and Arnold was like, Boyer said Arnold looked surprised that Boyer would even give him that idea. But after that, Boyer gave the idea, but it was right after that that I think a few people took claim on whose idea it was, but it was Boyer's. And Frank Zane received the first Sandow statuette.
1977.
Now they've changed the statuette now to add more muscle and stuff like
right.
that.
Right, I've seen that, yeah.
But that's the story between with the Sandow trophy. I wonder how much the Murray family sold that to Steve Rees for.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah, and why Rees then... Well, I know Rees became close with George Helmer but in the 90s and stuff, then before he died, maybe...
So who was the Murray family? They were the ones that created the statue in the beginning?
William Murray won it in 1901.
Oh, William Murray won it, okay.
He won the gold medal. Now, I think that's how we learned afterwards that these things were just plated, silver and gold plated. They weren't solid. I think earlier there would be solid gold and solid silver.
But someone else won the silver and the bronze, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the names of those individuals who won those trophies, but you know that'd be quite an acquisition. If I had that, that's one thing I probably would not sell.
Yeah,
because you know, Sandow is considered the father of modern bodybuilding, and you know, to have that trophy and his likeness of it, that's quite a find. I think Boyer did mention. Somebody paid $14,000 for that trophy, but I'm not sure which one it was. What you'd have to check with. I could check with Boyer and email to you.
The one that Reeves won in 1950, where did that come from? That was the bronze plated?
That was the bronze plated one. I thought, I wonder if Malcolm Wyatt or David Gentle or Roy Williams, Roy Edwards would know that. These guys are, you know, historians with their NABBA. Malcolm Wyatt might know, because he was, like I said, he was a right-hand man with Oscar Haydenstam going way back, right? So they might have an idea how they came.
The one that Reeves won in 1950, he held on to that then, right?
Well, it ended up with, yeah, it must have, because it ended up with George Helmer, and it might have come via Steve Reeves, yeah.
Okay.
Because, like I said, I don't know if he still has it or not.
So when Arnold and Lorimer started giving it to the Mr. Olympia winner in 1977, they just created their own statue.
Yeah, now, I read somewhere that Joe Weider had some type of copy. He had a copy.
Yeah, that makes sense, because he had a lot of those old statues.
Yeah, and I don't think he had the original bronze ones, but he had a copy of it, and they used his copy to make the statuette.
Okay, all right.
So, like I said, but they've altered it now. I would have left it the same.
Yeah, I would have too, yeah. The original concept of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so like the NABBA, this NABBA's still around. The IFBB has actually waned a little bit, but it's going to, like I said, there's a whole story that's unfolding right now with the rebuilding of an American amateur affiliate. It's called the IFBB Physique America. And that's okay. What Wayne D'Amelio is building to replace the NPC.
What's their plan for that? Are they going to have regional level shows all over and then have the, like a Mr. America as the national championship?
Yep, they are building a nationwide infrastructure, state-by-state promoters and chairman. He's building that now. He's going to be running all the qualifiers. The Mr. America probably will end up being the top-level national qualifier, but they're going to be able to compete in the world championships. They're going to be compete in, it's the old IFBB Mr. Universe, right?
Yeah, they're
going to compete in the international Arnold Classics. I think the NPC, Mannion still control of the Columbus Arnold Classic, but Raphael is going to be still running the International Arnolds. That's where these athletes can go compete. And a big step for amateur bodybuilding is representation at the Pan American Games next year.
I heard they're going to do drug testing. Are they doing drug testing?
They have to. WADA, World Anti-Doping, because otherwise, the Olympic, the IOC is actually interested again now because of they're going to do this. Now, the NPC does not have these avenues. Man, you can't offer these avenues because you can't go to the Pan American Games. You have to be connected up to the recognized international governing body of bodybuilding, and that's still the IFBB. So it doesn't matter what Mannion creates at an international level. He does not have that recognition.
Are they going to do testing then at all the shows or just the America that goes over to the World Championships?
I'm not sure at the all the levels of testing that's going to take place. Definitely at the larger shows like the Americas and stuff like that, or any team that's sent over there have to be drug-free. Because the USOC, the United States Olympic Committee, won't be at all interested. The Olympic effort fell flat earlier, you know, the first attempts with the weight, because the women came along and they're so bloody huge, women's bodybuilding, and it was clear that they weren't testing anything, and even in the men's, right? But Wayne is taking this route, and they have a good shot now at getting in there. So because the first step is the Pan American Games, and so only the IFBB Physique America has the avenue for this. So this is a big drawing power for this new American affiliate.
Mm-hmm. Are they still going to make the attempt to get into the Olympics like Ben Weider was?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. The United States Olympic Committee is interested in it actually, because they're taking this anti-doping route. And one, like I said, a step towards that is the Pan American Games.
Mm-hmm.
So,
will this new organization, are they going to offer the same type of categories that the NPC does? Figure, bikini, women's physique, men's physique?
Yeah, I'm not sure of all the different categories, but they're going to have that because they're there. They're here, right? That constitutes much of the shows these days.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if they have all of them, but they're going to have a good degree of them. So if you ever want to, the guy to speak to would be interviewed, would be Wayne D'Amelio. If you ever want that to happen, that's not a problem.
Yeah, I'm just interested in how that's all going to play out, because I know it's sort of new and they're just in the planning stages now.
It might be beneficial for you to stay out of the politics and just stick with the bodybuilding.
Right.
It's a good idea. You could ask me as a third party guy. You don't get in trouble that way.
Right, exactly.
But it's an exciting part in bodybuilding, and it's interesting to see what's gonna happen here. But where Wayne's approach is, you know what? You can compete to the amateur. You can compete where you want. You want to go compete in the NPC? You can go compete in the NPC, and the NPC athletes can come compete in the IFBB Physique America. But again, they may not bother if they're taking steroids. They might just say, you know what? I'm not going to bother going there. So, you know, but there are a lot of bodybuilding organizations, natural in they're just not all that big. They're more regional stuff. So, but Wayne's done it. He knows how to do it. He knows you have to build this infrastructure that the AAU had passed over to the NPC, right? The AAU had that national-wide infrastructure at the regional, state, city level that just became the inherited. The NPC just inherited that. So Wayne's, there's a lot of some embassy promoters who are not happy, and they're more than willing to speak with the new organization. So there's a lot of people interested, and it is growing. So it's going to be quite fascinating to see what happens there. And NAB is still around. I'm not ever sure what happened to the WAB, the WABA, you know, because I'm still, I kind of left off still in the early 80s, right? So I don't know all the things that have transpired outside of the IFBB and the NPC over the past 20 years.
That didn't last very long, did it, WABA?
Well, again, in 76, and right away, he joined up the next year with the NABA, and then they split.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how, like, Serge passed away a few years back, so.
Right.
I'm not sure how long he stayed in that before he got out. I would have probably tried to find that out if I had continued in the storyline there.
That was interesting because he was competing in his own organization. He was the president of the WAB organization, then he was competing in their championships as well, right?
Yeah, well, that's what Oscar didn't really was so keen of. So that was the end. Oscar, like, it was... Oscar, in Volume 2, I said Oscar was like Perry Rader, right?
Yeah,
they were two physical culturist guys. They understood, like, Perry understood that you had to do a certain amount of marketing, that you got to make money. But they were true physical culturists. And Oscar had, like I said, he's typical parochial, you know, British amateur, gentleman, you compete like a gentleman, where, in a lot of sports, you do anything to win.
Right.
Winning means money. I want money. Like, I mean, I don't care if I got to do this or that. I'm going to do it. And that was the total opposite. And Oscar just wouldn't go that route. And it cost him. Like, he had mortgaged his house a couple times to keep the magazine going. And
oh, really? Wow.
He doesn't get the recognition that he should. That's why, like, a good guy to interview would be like a Malcolm White or a David Gentle or they who know their British history. I'm a hack compared to them in terms of their British their history, right?
Right. So what's going on with you, Randy? Are you doing any more writing now?
I have book two, like I think that same as last time I talked to you, 70% drafted, but then I got caught up in another book project that I was working on. I have that 70% drafted, then I just kind of fizzed out and just been doing training and taking it easy.
That writing takes a long time. People don't realize, especially all the work you put into those first two volumes of Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors.
Yeah, those are a lot of work because it's not like writing a biography where you just write it out of your head, your story. Like, I have to painstakingly try to interview people, not just once, but several times. It depends on the mood you get them in, if they can remember.
Yeah.
If they're wrong, I got to play devil's advocate. Some of them get really angry with me, but I said, look, I'm just trying to get it accurate. I spend a lot of money and materials to get stuff. Now, a lot of guys are still alive and for the remainder of the story. Like, I mean, book two is the bizarre relationship between Wayne D'Amelia and the Weeders and the women. I've got these women chapters drafted for 8 years now, at least 6 to 8 years now that I just haven't. They were supposed to go in one part, then another part. So they would go definitely into this book. But the interesting story, up to the 1980s, because I remember women's bodybuilding in the early 80s. I thought it was going to eclipse male bodybuilding. It was meteoric.
It just shot
to the top, and then it just fell. The drugs killed it.
I think it was just the whole concept of women building muscles. I think it was just nobody ever saw that before, so it just fascinated all these mainstream media outlets, especially the big television networks, too.
Yeah, and it was like those early girls were sexy still, right? They were lean and muscular, but they weren't ripped and they weren't huge. But as the Corey, you had some like who were the big ones back then? Laura Coombs, Rachel. I'm not the ones who were a little bigger. Kay Baxter was bigger.
Okay. She, yeah,
And then Corey was bigger than, say, than the Rachel was, and then Kiki Aloma from, was it Finland, was but in the, then, like I said, Corey, Linda Murray started taking it bigger, and then Kravetsky, like, she kind of went over the line.
Right.
And then it just was gone, right? It just became a liability for the sport. Then men's took it over there, too. Like, I mean, for the longest time, male bodybuilding subsidized female bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
But then the male bodybuilding was over the top that these expos now start, and they still do today, subsidize the male shows.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have a successful contest these days at a big level without having running a big expo to cover the prize money and stuff like
that. Right, right. Absolutely.
So much has changed. So it'd be interesting to see with the, what D'Amelio's doing, rebuilding for the IFBB, with the IFBB Physique America organization, is if he's bought a drug test, these guys are now marketable again. These guys can now go on television and take the questions, right? Where back in the 70s, Arnold could go on TV, nobody's going to ask him. I think Barbara Walters asked him about steroids, but most of the people didn't. Most people just didn't, the public didn't know what they were, or they didn't know to ask about them. But now there's no way you're going to see Kai Green or Phil Heath on any television show. They're going to go, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And that's not real. That's not normal. So, I mean, they can't market it to anybody. Because most people don't want to look that way. I don't. You probably don't either. I saw it, like, when I could see, you had a great physique, the natural way. Like, I mean, you look back at the 60s, you look at guys, those black and white photos like Don Holworth and Larry Scott.
Yeah.
You had to think, who would want more muscle than that?
Right, right.
So, but what they did with the drugs now, they're just so blown out all over. Like, nobody even really wants to look like that. There's a small niche, and there always will be. And stuff. And but the risk these guys are taking with their health, they're just like little experiments. So I'm hoping that Wayne's efforts and the IPB efforts at the Olympic level are successful, because the sport will get some respect back. And it's a different time. It's a different era, you know, because they'll be looking, well, that guy's the bodybuilding champion. Well, I'm bigger than him. Yeah, but you're not drug tested, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the average guy in the gym now is taking steroids and
build a big
physique. And he's looking at, say, a Mr. America who is natural. He's probably going to be bigger than Mr. America.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That was the cool thing back in the 40s and the 50s, that you can say, when those guys were natural, you can say, you know what? I can maybe came Mr. America, but my arms are as big as that guy's, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then when the genetics really kicked in the 60s and the steroids came in, the big rift between your natural average guy and the Mr. Universe or Mr. Olympia, then it was...
Plus, people weren't really working out back then, you know, so to see a bodybuilder was something unusual, you know. Now everybody works out, you know, it's not unusual to work out.
Yeah, that's also what helped... the weeders get power over, like I said, the recognizable names through this late the 60s and 70s. It was the IFBB bodybuilders like Dave Draper, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lou Ferrigno showing up on TV in Pumping Iron. I guess, you know, Draper was all over the TV in the 60s, and there's Lou and Arnold all through the 70s, and those are all IFBB bodybuilders. Even though they didn't want to acknowledge Joe Weider at the time, they did later. But Joe didn't like that, because Joe still promoted that marketing cartoon image, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But those bodybuilders and TV and the health consciousness that rose, all it was all timing. Like everything in it is, it's all timing, right? And the Weeders had the right people in the right place at the right time, and in their own efforts, I won't shortchange them. Joe was great at publishing and stuff like that with the stuff, but he had good guys like. Orlick, Early, State, D'Amelio, Sprague, you know, those guys did a lot of work to move Joe and the Weeders into power.
Yeah. Okay, Randy. Well, I want to thank you for joining us again for the show and giving us that information on the NAVA universe. That was some really good history there. Hopefully we'll talk to you again and have you on the show again on our next subject, whatever that may be, because you're always a great source of information. And we wish you the best with everything you're working on, too.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Randy. Take care, buddy.
Bye now.
Bye. All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thanks to Randy Roach for joining us. And I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine, Redcon One, and Old School Labs for sponsoring this edition of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.